out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. For me, this lovely quote from Rumi represents the place we all get to play, a zero point. Before traditions and dogmas, religions all came out of this same field of love, and I think we can find that healing traditions worldwide also have similar beginnings. Today's guest is Dr. Victoria Sweet. She is a medical doctor and also has a doctorate in history and social medicine. Her book, Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing, adds just the right fuel to the slow food movement. I'm Robin. Stay tuned for Tributaries. Victoria, thank you so much for joining us today for Tributaries.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
Your book, Slow Medicine, came off of the heels of your book, God's Hotel. Can you share the segue from the focus of God's Hotel and how you were led to write Slow Medicine?
Yes. Well, God's Hotel was, Slow Medicine is kind of a prequel to God's Hotel, but it also goes through God's Hotel and comes out the other side. God's Hotel was a story of the 20 years I spent at a really unusual hospital in San Francisco, which had originally been the San Francisco almshouse, and which, for the 20 years I was there, it looked like a medieval castle with hundreds of patients, and where I had the time to really do a traditional doctor job on the patients. I had the time to really listen to them, examine them, get their back history, talk to their docs, look at their records, take them off the medications they didn't need, figure out the right diagnosis. And it was incredibly satisfying, especially since those same 20 years saw a completely different push to turn medicine into healthcare, a commodity to be delivered, you know, like in a retail store, patients, consumers, the focus not being on healing or curing or taking care of patients, but on efficiency and producing health care. So I had these two conflicting things going on, and the other third thing that I talked about in God's Hotel, which influenced me, was I decided to go back and get a PhD in medical history because I felt like there was this whole piece of medicine that had been left behind, this whole idea that when we have enough time as patients to heal, as doctors to find out the right diagnosis, as nurses to care and take care of our patients, when we have enough time, really fantastic things happen. And when we don't have enough time and we're rushed and we treat the body like a machine and healthcare like a commodity, not only does all that get lost, but our outcomes are not nearly as good. So I went back to see how it was that piece went missing. And I discovered this 12th century mystic theologian, nun, abbess, and medical practitioner named Hildegard of Bingen, who, while I was doing my PhD on her to understand the kind of medicine she practiced almost 1,000 years ago, she actually kind of hit the charts, so to speak. People started recording her music, and so she became a somewhat known figure. So I wrote God's Hotel to kind of tie together these three strands, all based on, I think, a holistic, not the holistic we know from the 70s and 80s, but a whole view of the body that takes into account these different ways of looking at the body. So I wrote that book as a novice, and it just took off. So for several years, I've just been going around the world to translate into all these different languages, and the longer I spoke to people, and this is the genesis of slow medicine, the more I became aware that what I was talking about was becoming more and more foreign to how people thought about, now I'm going to call it healthcare, that it needed explanation, more explanation than I thought. And so I ended up writing Slow Medicine as a way to answer, what do I mean by slow medicine as opposed to fast medicine? How did I come to it? And I decided to do that by telling my own story of how I went from a person with really no interest in medicine to a kind of passionate practitioner and medical philosopher, I would almost call myself. So with slow medicine, I tell all the stories, these turning points for me when I realized what it was like to really examine the patient and what kind of effects you get. So that's how slow medicine came into being.
Yes, and I was just speaking with someone recently who said, I think every scientist should be a philosopher first. So I was happy to hear you just say that now, sort of a philosophy of medicine, because that certainly opens it up, doesn't it? It takes it out of that dogmatic black and white.
That's kind of interesting. That's interesting that you say opens it up. I like that idea. I never thought of it that way, but as opening it up, right? One of the reasons I went to medical school was because I really wanted to deal with the essential of life. You know, I didn't really want to... it seemed important. But life has always seemed really important to me. Mm-hmm. Still does. Just the fact that we exist. The fact that anything exists, the fact that it's so beautiful, that it's so poignant, that there's suffering, that there's death. I wanted to really jump into it. That's actually why I went to medical school. And I found that doing that changed me in a way I never would have been changed, I don't think. And I'm not talking about anybody else's life, but for who I, my natural temperament, is a bit cooler and more analytical, and that was advantageous as a doc. But if I hadn't done medicine, I think those characteristics would have hypertrophied, and these other characteristics that I had to learn to be less objective, more subjective, more myself, I got to change, and that, you know, what I'm calling philosophy has to do with getting to see it, you know, see birth, see death a lot, see people almost die and then come back. Just the whole experience, I think, is, it does end you up with a philosophy.
Yes, of course.
That way, I think.
Yes, and when you see death, some of the mystery about it disappears, but I think it works both ways. I think some of the mystery mm-hmm. about it disappears, but then on the other hand, it just opens up this whole other, wow, the heart stopped.
Yes.
And now what is there going on? You wrote in your time in medical school that it was a confrontation of opposites. What are you talking about, and has it changed now that you're recognizing and seeing and mm-hmm. actually being a part of this slow medicine movement?
It's a great question, Robin. That's a really interesting. Well, it certainly was at the time, and it was a confrontation of opposites, both in myself and what was going on in the society at the time. I started medical school in the early 70s, 1970s, and there was a confrontation of the opposites going on, just starting in the society, I think, or just revealing itself in the society. And the kind of opposites are, you know, we came out of, as a nation, we came out of World War II with this, you know, can-do, this can-do way about us. In the 50s, and said, we can do everything. It was a very extroverted, a Jungian sense, a very linear, a very Darwinian, a very capitalist, a very fast, analytical way of being. And that has been incredibly effective. We have the benefits of that now over the last 50, 60 years. I mean, amazing quote-unquote progress, but a whole bunch of other things got left behind. And starting in the 70s, they started to get clear, and you could call it, I don't really like male versus female, but I'm going to use it for the moment. I don't think it's accurate, but I think it's good enough. You know, we have the opposites of male and female. We have the opposites of rational and emotional and linear and complex. And there were many confrontations that grew out of that. But I think the main thing was the confrontation of the opposites itself. And what I mean by that is today, in some ways, what we're seeing is this huge confrontation going on, like just exhibited by the Democrats and the Republicans and the left and the right. And it's huge. You just can't even imagine how they're ever going to agree. And yet this confrontation of the opposites comes out of Jungian thought, and Carl Jung's insight was that the stronger this confrontation gets, the more impassable, the more solid it seems, the inside each of the two groups confronting each other is actually the growth of its own opposite. And actually what's going on now is, to the extent that the left can't see the benefits of the right and the right can't see what the left is, actually inside them is something that identifies with their opposite, that they're fighting against. Does that make sense?
Oh, it does to me, certainly. Yes, I agree.
Okay. So it's actually kind of an interesting moment because, so for me personally, those confrontation of the opposites was, I specifically talked when I was first in medical school, and being a woman was very unusual, not completely unusual, thank heavens. I had 6 other women in our class, one woman on the faculty of 126, was to figure out how to be a woman doctor. Because even today, if you think about it, but certainly even more at the time, doctors were not just in reality men, but doctors were to express, the best doctor was expressing male fatherly characteristics. So cool, calm, rational, objective. And women, especially then, because that was one of the opposites going on, is male-female, right? Well, women were the opposite. They were supposedly warm and compassionate and emotional and flighty and not rational and all these kinds of things. So how was I going to be a woman doctor? It was a contradiction in terms. And I actually quote, in that book, I quote William Osler's, who was the dean of American medicine in the early 1900s. He kind of invented a lot of what we see as traditional medical practices. He's brilliant. And he was forced to take women into the new medical school he had created at Johns Hopkins. And somebody asked him what he thought about women doctors. And he said, as far as he was concerned, there were 3 sexes, men, women, and women doctors. And it's a wonderful phrase, because throughout my life, I've thought about that. And I ended up back to the philosophy and this feeling of wholeness, is that we all need to learn to be women doctors. We all need to learn to be both rational and emotional, both cool and warm, objective and subjective. So whether we call them male, female, or call them some animus and anima, or whether we call them something else, it's learning how to be both of those things at the same time, which is in some ways brings back to this whole idea of slow medicine and this idea that slow medicine, as opposed to fast medicine, so fast medicine is thinking of the body as a machine, thinking of disease as a broken machine, thinking of the doctor as a mechanic that fixes or repairs a broken part, is a very useful approach, used at the right time in the right place.
You wrote about how medicine moved away from doing things in order of urgency. And I found that interesting, because I think naturally the body just goes to the urgent first. Just the fact where oxygen goes to first, the brain will take it away from the organs, for instance, if there isn't enough, and everything sort of prioritizes to keep the body alive.
Well, that's true. And if you know about the body, if you've taken care of the body, if you're in your own body, if you have that kind of knowledge, it's obvious. But if you're someone who has never done that, but are a computer programmer, let's say, who's 22 years old and has never been sick, and is told to put together a medical record, electronic medical record algorithm. He doesn't know that. So what order does he use? Well, the most natural order for a computer is, for instance, alphabetical. Alphabetical. And I'm telling you, that is how our electronic medical records are ordered. It makes me insane. So when I get now some complicated patient who's been in the hospital for a whole long time, I don't get, wow, the patient had a major heart attack, and then he developed, you know, congestive heart failure, and then he developed hypokalemia from the treatment for his congestive heart failure, and then he got delirious. No, I get A, ambulation, you know, B, bronchitis, C, congestive heart failure, D, you know, drug overdose, E, esophagus, in no order at all. It's an alphabetical order.
Oh,
and
wow.
The medications are in alphabetical order. I actually would rewrite. I'd have to rewrite when I get a consultation from somebody else that's been done alphabetically. I have to rewrite it because there's no content to alphabetization, right? I mean, if you think urgency alone tells a story.
Absolutely,
right?
Yes.
If I tell you what happened in terms of urgency, you can almost infer this story. And if I write my medications list in terms that match the urgency, you don't even need the diagnosis. If I just give you the medications in terms of their urgency and how they write what they're for, you can infer back what happened. So that's kind of what happened with urgency.
Right. Yes. I think that was great. I think that was a great thing for all of us to hear. And also, when you shared about statistics in slow medicine, it's pretty eye-opening, isn't it? Because, for instance, you talk about the time before antibiotics, and 25% mm-hmm. of the people would die from pneumonia. And why don't you share a little bit more about that?
Well, that's just a fascinating piece, and that has to do. That's a piece that's actually really important to my heart. So I might get off too far in it. I hope not, but it does take a little bit of explanation. But basically, one of the things that made modern medicine so powerful was the discovery of statistics. And was asking, this happened in the 1820s, it happened like almost 200 years ago, when we didn't use statistics. Doctors just passed along what seemed to work to them. It was pretty effective. But around the 1820s, they started to say, well, you know, we know the body heals itself some of the time, right? So if we give somebody a medication, it should really have to show that it heals more than doing nothing. So that was kind of the discovery or the decision that for our medications that we give patients, we should have some proof, not so much that they work, but that they work better than doing nothing. And that's how these studies began. It wasn't obvious. We only started really having studies that compared nothing, i.e. giving somebody a sugar pill, that was considered nothing, to the pill itself. And those studies started about 100 years ago, and I've always found them fascinating because they always give you, by definition, they also have to tell you what happens when you didn't give the patient that medication, when you did nothing. And that's called it's called the placebo effect. But really, what it is, it's the healing power of the body's effect, right?
Yes.
So with pneumonia, the old statistics that they started keeping track of before they started doing studies on medications showed that 75% of the time, the patient with pneumonia actually got better. 25% of the time, the people died. So that tells you a lot. Right? That says, well, if I give a patient a medicine for pneumonia, it has to work better than 75% of the time because every medication is expensive. every medication has side effects. If it doesn't work better than 75% of the time, why use it? So today, the question has gotten very muddied. And I tell my patients and anybody who asks, it's really important when your doctor is going to give you a medicine that you ask him or her, you know, what are the side effects? What are the adverse reactions? And what's the difference if I take this medicine between taking this medicine and not taking the medicine? I think it's really important because most of the time, if you add in all the bad things that medication does, it doesn't really outweigh the good things it does as often as you might think.
Right. And when you first heard about macrobiotics, and I know we're going back a bit in your life and career, mm-hmm. You said how you worried over how controlled studies could be done. And did it occur to you how ancient the system was, and did it matter? And are you a fan of always doing controlled studies at this point in time?
That's kind of a complex question. You know, I like history, and so I think that something that goes back, you know, macrobiotics is an offshoot, really, of Chinese medicine. And as it turns out, when I started to study European medicine, pre-modern medicine, and Hildegard, I realized it was kind of eerie that the medicine that we used to use in Europe before this machine model took over is exactly analogous to Chinese medicine. It's hot and cold, space, the yin-yang, hot and cold, wet and dry, balance, this idea of fluids flowing and blockages. It's amazingly the same theory. I got really fascinated by that. I respect tradition a lot, but I think that I personally, for my own health, I trust the wisdom of my own body more than anything. So I don't consider that a Chinese medicine that I might take is any better or worse, probably a little bit better than a pill, but it's still putting something in my body that isn't a food, right? It's not something I naturally eat. So I like to have some sense that, wow, you know, it's benefits outweigh its risks. So I've never been a person to think that because, you know, we use juice of the salix tree is better than aspirin in terms of or has less side effects. I think it's likely to have less side effects. And since you're in Colorado, let me say that, you know, I think it's interesting to see that the instant that marijuana becomes legal, it suddenly starts getting parsed out until it's synthetic chemical ingredients.
I know. That's
right. Dronabinol and cannabinoids and all this stuff. And sold back to us as liquids or pills. I mean, there seems to be something wonderful about nature. And I don't think anything doesn't have a side effect. I would rather know that something worked than that it didn't work. I do have a bias towards tradition, and I do have a bias towards using plants. But then, of course, I want to know, where does the plant come from? Who grew the plant? What's in the plant?
Right.
You know, does it have pesticides all over it? I don't think it's obvious.
Right. And I could probably hear you speak about Hildegard for a few interviews worth of time. Did she have a plant-based ideology of the body as well? And maybe you could just share one thing that means, since we're on a short leash.
So I studied Hildegard in part because, you know, she was this 12th century woman. She wrote the first book of practical medicine we have in the West that actually was attached to a real live person that we knew a lot about. Galen wrote in the Roman times, but we don't really know whether he actually practiced. But Hildegard, because she ended up as a saint and a mystic, people kept track of her. They saved everything. So she's actually like a real person. And there's a tremendous amount of information from her own time. You know, the books she wrote, really cool. It's just thrilling. And plants were her main armamentarium. And in fact, when she came to write a book, she created her own language. Nobody knows why. Nobody knows what it was for. But 2/3 of the words in her language are plant names. fascinating. So plants were a big deal. And her main model of the body, I realized as I studied her over the years, was not body as machine, but that the body was more like a plant and that the doctor was more like a gardener. And there's a big difference. There's many differences between a body and a machine, but the big difference I usually focus on is that a plant heals itself and a machine doesn't heal itself. Hildegard's philosophy was as a gardener. You mostly try and see what's in its way, of flourishing and removing what's in its way. So it's a very different focus. The body as machine has a very analytical focus. I got to go down to the cell level, find a broken piece of DNA and replace it. Hildegard's model, and she represents thousands of years of European medical care, is to step back, put the patient, like you would a garden plant that wasn't doing well, in the context of the environment and ask, what's in the way of this patient thriving? And when you think about it, it's a believer's point of view when you think about it, because it assumes that the body is basically good and that if you remove what's in the way of it thriving, it will thrive.
At one point, you pose the question, have we no room for prophets?
Yeah. I know. There are a lot of prophets. I don't know what to say about that, Robin. I think we should just leave it. Have we no room for prophets? Prophets with a P, not with an F. We have plenty of room for profit. How about that? Room for profit, but not room for profit. Thank you so much, Robin. I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure, and it was kind of interesting because actually, like particularly being led where you were kind of pushing me, is it something I don't put forward necessarily, but I do think it's philosophical.
Well, that was fun. Many thanks to Dr. Victoria Sweet, author of Slow Medicine. To re-listen to this broadcast or listen to other archives or anything we do here on Tributaries, it's tributariesradio.com, and our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.